Welcome to Theatre Voice. This is Heather Neal, and I'm with actor-director Samuel West during a break in rehearsals for T.S. Eliot's The Family Reunion. Sam West, described by playwright Patrick Marber as the most writer-friendly director I've worked with, comes fresh from the success of Harley Granville Barker's Waste at the Almeida. But this time he's donning his other hat and playing Harry, the troubled son of an upper-middle-class English family who's been absent for 8 years. During this time, his wife has drowned in mysterious circumstances. Now he's attending the birthday celebrations of his mother, Amy, at a gathering of the family. But before we talk about preparations for this production, just a bit more background. Sam West is well known as an actor in film, especially perhaps as Leonard in Howard's End, but he's also in Iris and Notting Hill and various other films. And on television, he was Anthony Blunt in Cambridge Spies, and on stage, last year he got rave reviews for the cuckolded husband Robert in Pinter's Betrayal at the Donmar. And he's also run a building, the Crucible at Sheffield, until it was closed for refurbishment in 2007. And his directing credits include a spectacularly successful production of Dealer's Choice last year, which led to that comment by its author, Patrick Marber. Well, the first obvious question is, to what extent acting and directing influence each other? Is it harder to take notes, in this case from Jeremy Herrin, when you've just been in charge of a highly successful production yourself?
It's never difficult to take notes from Jeremy Herrin. What a nice introduction, incidentally. Thank you very much. No, I think it's easier. At least I maintain it's easier, and so far the directors that have worked with me since I started directing have always said they wanted to work with me again, and in some cases have. So no, I maintain I'm easier to direct now that I direct, mostly because I'm delighted that it's not my problem anymore. Well, it's very useful when you're directing actors, particularly in Waste, which is very much an actor-based play, to know how actors like to talk and like to be given notes, although all actors vary in this case, but it does help to know what an actor needs to know in order to be able to play a scene as well as they can. And also, I've worked with quite a lot of directors, which quite a lot of directors haven't done, and so it is possible to bring, one hopes, the best of what they take into the rehearsal room into my own. The most useful thing of which is always, you know, love, support, and an enjoyable, safe place to be dangerous. And we were extremely lucky with Waste. It's the most fabulously talented and happy company, I think. And I rather miss them. Not because this isn't just as enjoyable, but because putting your other hat on and then coming and doing something else is, you know, you have to make sure that the switch is complete. And I only had 7 days in between opening Waste and starting rehearsal, so although I went on holiday, it was quite a quick swapping of heads.
Yes, that was not much of a turnaround time at all. And did that mean you did a lot of reading in between on holiday?
Yes, I mean, I did a bit of reading and a bit of resting. It's the first time for several years that I've not known my lines by the read-through. I don't like that, and particularly with a... I knew about half of them, I think, but particularly with a play like this, which, as we'll discuss, is in verse and fairly wrought verse at that. It's important to, you know, have that under your belt as soon as possible. I've also got quite a troublesome cough, which may be cat-based, and that's been going on since I started Waste rehearsal, so that's made it slightly more wearing than usual as well.
Well, you come from a theatrical family. Your famous parents, of course, are Prunella Scales and Timothy West, but I think they were actors and other theatre people in previous generations. So was your career an obvious one? You were at Oxford, weren't you? And you actually acted with Patrick Marber, I think, at Oxford. But what did you, at that point, know what you wanted to do?
No, not at all. I studied English at Oxford and I did an awful lot of plays, some of them, most of them, probably not very well. But no, I didn't really know that it was what I wanted to do until I left. I'd done a little bit professionally before I went, but I did a film very soon after I left and enjoyed that very much, and it turned out very well. I was very proud of it, so I thought, well, I'll try and put off going to drama school because I seem to be working. And wish I hadn't, actually. I do think people should train, and I enjoy working in drama schools when I'm asked. But, four generations of actors, which is very interesting for playing Harry, of course, who is a lord and therefore inherits a title, because I found in rehearsals that I was inordinately interested in the family tree, partly because I'm a bit of a geek and I like being able to fill in that sort of detail, partly because I think it's essential to know that sort of detail, but I think also because Harry does feel himself under that sort of pressure, and the journey of the character in the end and his possible escape, although it's only into a different sort of slavery, is to avoid that arrow of destiny that crashes down through the generations, pinning, you know, first sons to the title over and over again, and go out into the wilderness and try and be somebody different. So that's something that as an actor I've failed to do, given that I went into the family business, but I think I know what he's on about.
Yeah, well, you've started talking about Harry. Obviously, Elliot wasn't aiming for naturalism, and yet there's an awful lot going on psychologically. How you've approached him? You could see him as someone who's mentally ill, couldn't you?
I think he sees himself as somebody who's mentally ill. I think he was going for naturalism, incidentally. Oh. I mean, he talks about, in that he writes in verse, one wouldn't say it was completely naturalistic, but he talks about a new style of writing after Murder in the Cathedral, which he felt had gone about as far as it could go in terms of verse drama, that that the style of the family reunion was to be more naturalistic. I mean, I think he never thought of writing in prose, but mostly because the sort of things he's trying to write about are too complex, changeable, vague for prose. And this was something that I knew from directing Christopher Fry. I did The Ladies Not for Burning as my first professional job.
That was in Chichester, wasn't it?
In 2002, and we became quite good friends and talked about it a lot. And of course I said to him, why do you write in verse? And he said, because the world is extraordinary and prose won't cut it. Mm. There's only one language that I feel can get anywhere close to chipping the edges off the amazing thing that is reality, and it's got to be poetic. And it's not self-consciously poetic, it's just what he needs. So I think probably, you know, the fight with this incredibly wrought and complex language is to make it sound like you're making it up in the first instance, and also that it's the only language you could use. So you must never sound like you'd rather be paraphrasing.
Mm. Should people who are listening think, oh, I'm listening to poetry, or should they think, I'm listening to a play, that's it?
They shouldn't think either. They should think, I'm listening to a person.
Yes.
I mean, I have to use phrases like the partial anaesthesia of suffering without feeling and partial observation of one's own automatism. And those are difficult things to get your head round, but in the moment, they have to be the words I choose to use.
Mm.
And so, first of all, I have to be somebody who has that vocabulary, and I have to need to want to put it in that way. But certainly, if you thought, "Oh, he's speaking poetry," I mean, I'm afraid that I'm very, very sensitive to the voice poetic, you know, the stuff that the voice that one puts on when reading something in order to make it sound like it's poetry. I can't bear it. It makes me switch off, or, you know, actually or metaphorically. And stop listening. The note I give most often in plays when that happens is, it's not a play.
But you do have particular notes that you give to actors as well, don't you? About stress, for instance, in lines, in sentences.
I find it much easier to listen to poetry when it's stressed lightly. Well, indeed, life when it's stressed lightly. It's something that I was sort of brought up with, partly as music and partly as a principle that my mother sometimes taught at drama schools. But if you listen to anybody, Barack Obama is a very good example. He's called an orator. What does that mean? It means that he stresses very lightly. It means that he has long, rolling sentences, but he holds the stress up in them to keep your ear interested. He tickles your ear along the way. He will go through a subclause without stressing it. He will take another, and finally he will hit that final image. And because you've been waiting on the edge of this great rolling breaker of a sentence, you will scream your enthusiasm just because of the way he stressed the sentence. Now, that's also true of comics. Overstress a punchline and it's not funny. I find just it very useful to remind oneself that, I think it was Gielgud said it originally about Shaw, George Bernard, I mean, that there was only one stress in every sentence of Shaw. I found it useful to believe that there was only one main stress in every sentence of English. And certainly in Waste, that's been true. It sounds more natural, it allows you to speak more quickly, it's clearer. You can break it all the time for the sense of comedy and character, but as a principle, it's worth observing.
Well, one of your earlier successes, which I didn't mention in the introduction, was Hamlet with the RSC. And when you were preparing that, I sat in on a session you did with Cicely Berry about verse speaking, Shakespeare's verse. Does that kind of background help with modernist verse? Family Reunion was written in 1939, as we haven't mentioned that.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think it's important for actors to be able to work in registers that are not their own. In fact, it's essential. Otherwise, you just end up playing yourself now, and that's not very interesting, really. I mean, the same principle applies to Shakespeare, that you have to treat it as a new play, and your choice of verse as just something that your character does. It's actually harder with Eliot, because I think he's a writer who's more present in his works than Shakespeare. I mean, the extraordinary thing about Shakespeare, as anyone who's been in his work will know, is that I think I've been in 15 of his plays, if you include the ones I've done on radio, and I have precious little idea what he was like as a man. Mm. Whereas you can see one play by T.S. Eliot and you know exactly what he's like. The choice of words perhaps feels more like Eliot than you when you're in a T.S. Eliot play. But you have to do your best to counteract that tendency, I think.
Mm. Well, how do you feel about Eliot here? I mean, people have described him as a fascist and an anti-Semitic. I mean, does this kind of thing stay in the back of your mind, or can you put it all away, and can the play stand on its own despite what you say about him being present in it?
It can and must, I think. It's a very interesting question. I'm left-wing and atheist, so I'm neither Eliot's brother politically or religiously, but I also believe that, you know, Beethoven and Wagner had their dodgy beliefs, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't listen to Beethoven or Wagner. I suppose I would find it hard to sympathise with or even want to be in a play by Eliot if it espoused anti-Semitic values or Nazism or, you know, child murder or any of the things that one is called on to espouse playing parts. But I don't think that his political beliefs intrude into this play nearly as much as his religious ones. And what is fascinating and difficult for a non-believer is to centre on and trust the idea of redemption that lies behind this play, or the possibility of redemption that lies behind this play and lies behind Christianity. Because, of course, that's what Eliot adds to the Greek story.
Yes, yes. Yes, well, you mentioned the Greeks. The Aeschylus is at the back of this. Did you, the Eumenides, did you do a lot of work on the Greeks as well? And how does it marry with the 1939, the almost like drawing room comedy elements and Christianity? It's a very complex mixture, isn't it?
Yes, I tried to find a phrase for what sort of play it was, and I came up with a pagan, Greek, mythic, Christian, psychological murder mystery tragedy. it's just one of those, you know, really. There's a lot of them around. It is mostly, I think, a country house murder mystery. The myth, the Orestian myth, gives shape and pattern to the idea of the story. I think what what Eliot comes back to over and over again, as Pinter does, actually, who's a great admirer of this play. It's very interesting. It's a sort of cross between No Man's Land and The Homecoming, I think, in Pinteresque terms. That the search to recover the past in order to redeem the past is what animates all of us, probably in a Freudian sense as well. But what's interesting, and I think more interesting about this play than Orestes or the Orestian myth, is that It takes the idea of Greek tragedy, in which one's life is ruled by implacable fate, which one can endure but not overcome. You know, Ray Fiennes at the moment is down the road is suffering the horrors of Oedipus because he makes a mistake, and sorry, that's just the way the gods want it to be. I'm not suffering in the same way at the end of the play because, although I am haunted by the Eumenides for believing that I have murdered my wife, indeed I am haunted because I am a murderer in my own terms, I can, because it's a Christian play, find atonement. I can exchange suffering for sin and go out there and help people and possibly find redemption. And twice a night on Saturdays.
And do you think that's something a modern audience can respond to in the way that perhaps Eliot would have hoped?
I wonder if the idea of redemption is as popular as it was. We rehearsed through the Jonathan Ross, Russell Brand furore. And whatever you think about those people, what was interesting about the judgment that was passed down in the end was the idea that they ought to redeem themselves in some way for a perceived sin, I suppose. Is that too strong a word? Mistake, slight, whatever you want to call it. I wouldn't want to judge that one way or the other, but it was interesting how strong, leaving aside the Daily Mail readers, how strong the feeling was that having done something that people thought was wrong, you were then allowed to make things better by saying it was sorry, going away and thinking about it for a bit. And I think that is quite an unfashionable idea, but perhaps it shouldn't be, because that's the idea behind justice, after all. You know, and it does tend to wipe the slate and mean that people can live, you know, guilt-free lives. Mm. Everybody makes mistakes. The question is, what do we do next?
Well, you mentioned Pinter. This play seems to come somewhere between music hall and Pinter. It's quite extraordinary that you can see a kind of line in the repetition, for instance, in the language. Can you not? Maybe I'm mentioning that because I know you're a fan of the Marx Brothers, and I don't know whether all this adds up together.
I am an enormous fan of the Marx Brothers, and thank you for reminding me. I think a lot of the joy of it comes from two people. I mean, me and somebody else, me and Agatha, me and Mary me and Penelope Wilton, and me and Hattie Moran in the play, trying to play out really quite...
That's an aunt and a cousin.
That's an aunt and a cousin, exactly. Quite a deep probing personal excavation of the past and what might have gone wrong to screw us up so badly. In the middle of this country house party about my mother's birthday, and my brother's trying to make it and having, you know, accidents in their cars, and telegrams coming to the house saying that, you know, so-and-so is ill and, or, you know, hurt. And I think Eliot is having fun with that. And I must say I adore that. I think this sort of subverting of genre is really jolly, because it doesn't really care what play it is. And I'm not sure that we have that same genre-busting desire now in our playwrights. I mean, we have many, many other desires, and some of them, you know, very proper. But in terms of the explosion of form that this play represents, I mean, mixing a country house thing with a Christian redemption story and then throwing in the Eumenides for good measure. I'm not sure anybody's doing on quite that scale, possibly Carol Churchill. But Carol is now 70 years old, as we now know, so, you know, who's next? That's what I want to know.
Yes, and yet it's been terribly out of fashion. I mean, why do you think that is, Eliot? I mean, it's we haven't seen Eliot's plays much for a very long time, apart from Murder in the Cathedral and the one production of Family Reunion, which the RSC did about 8 years ago.
They're very difficult. I think they probably go wrong quite a lot of the time. I mean, you know, this thing that John Gielgud said, style is knowing what play you're in. It's very difficult to say what play you're in when you're in Family Reunion. And certainly, just packing the meaning of the words takes a good proportion of your 5 weeks rehearsal, if you're lucky enough to have 5 weeks rehearsal. Mm. They're in verse, and a lot of the words are difficult. And I think that the legacy of Osborne, you know, chucked a lot of very healthy babies out with the kitchen sink bathwater, as it were, including Christopher Fry. It was very interesting to me in 2000 to be doing a reading of The Lady's Not for Burning on the set of Look Back in Anger, a perfectly decent production at the National Theatre that reminded me of what I thought of Look Back in Anger, which is that although it's got some absolutely thrilling speeches in it and Jimmy Porter is a force of nature, the play is quite creaky and feels old-fashioned to me. And I think, though it was necessary at the time and must have swept through, you know, London and possibly England with force of a bullet, reviving it didn't seem to me as exciting as reviving The Lady's Not for Burning, which spoke to me incredibly, truly and freshly with a beautiful directness and simplicity, even though it was in verse. So when I chose to direct the first thing I had the chance to direct, it was Christopher Fry instead. And now we're far enough away, you know, the Royal Court's just had their 50th anniversary, so we're now 50 years from that play. And reviving something like Waste, which of course is another Royal Court play, but now 100 years old, or this, or Christopher Fry, or, you know, John Whiting and Jellicoe, I think we're far enough away to say it's all interesting now, it's all good, let's just see what speaks to us and do it because of that. And I'm very pleased that the Donmar's chosen this as part of that movement, because it's very important that, you know, subsidised theatres should revive things. It's how we justify our subsidy, I think.
Well, the version I've got to read is your rehearsal version, but it's actually called a version. Does that mean there have been any cuts, or is that just a that's just an accident of...
Yes, it is just an accident. In fact, the Elliott Estate are extremely sensitive about cuts, and properly so. But yeah, I mean, you don't mess with a single line. Like Pinter, actually. Mm. Well, like all that. Like all writers, you know. I mean, I live with a playwright, and when young actors come to me and say, what's your advice for somebody going into the profession? I say, keep solvent so you don't have to do rubbish. Try and be happy at your friend's success, and remember that writers are the real stars. And so we should always have that much respect for a text. We've managed to cut one line that makes reference to a sofa, because Jeremy didn't want to have a sofa. But we had to ask permission, and they gave it.
There are some very difficult lines, aren't there, with words hardly ever used anywhere, let alone in daily conversation.
Yeah, I've never had to say Batrachian before.
No.
It yes, means that, like a frog instead of...
So, what do you do when you come across a line like that? If I remember correctly, that line is followed by another line with a couple of very difficult words in it.
Where the dead stone is seen to be Batrachian, the aphilous branch, Ophidian, which means the leafless branch, like a snake.
Well, so there you are. So Theatre Voice listeners are ahead when they go to the audience of this.
Well, you don't do anything. You don't explain the line for the benefit of an audience that, strictly speaking, isn't there. You are playing somebody who chooses to use that word. And
we don't need to understand absolutely every word.
I find The Wasteland a very difficult poem unless I hear it. When somehow it gets to me or round me through my ears, it seeps in. And I think that that is a large part of Eliot's effect. We know now that sound alters us when it comes into our bodies. It makes us vibrate. That's how sound works. In a much greater way than vision does. So I believe in the ability to be moved by the noise of a play at least as much as I do the ability to be excited by the look of it. And that's not to say that this is just a radio play with standing up and we know our lines, but maybe what that line is meant to suggest is that Harry is in a place where he uses the word batrachian rather than frog-like, because that's the way the world seems to him. He's in a very strange place. He calls himself later insane when he says that line, or when he's in that place. So it may be a sort of form of nonsense speak. I certainly don't think it's something that you should pause to explain to the audience.
But there are parts of this play which are a bit like drawing room comedy. Some of it's quite funny, isn't it? Do you think Eliot was satirising the theatre of the time?
Oh yes, I think so. He has a very interesting relationship with Englishness, because he was famously, you know, wanted to be as English as possible, and put on this extraordinary sort of slightly unsuccessful accent with which he reads his poetry, incidentally with almost no stress, entirely uninflected, his own reading of his own poetry. So he sort of leaves it to you. You write the play. Certainly you write The Wasteland, I think. And that's very good. But yeah, he seemed to be sort of quite a playful person, in not very amusing ways, I think. Certainly he had a great regard for nonsense writers, and believed Edward Lear was, you know, one of the great English writers. Actually, I agree with him about Edward Lear. But yes, I think sending up genres sticking two fingers up rather than waving his cap at a particular style was certainly something he was at, and that must have been easier being American in the first instance, I think. But what's fascinating about studying Eliot's work, particularly the poetry, of course, is that for so long after it came out in the 20s and the 30s and up till really quite recently, the game was spot the illusion and you know, pat yourself on the back for being somebody who could decode Eliot. And I don't think that the relationship between Eliot the man and Eliot the work is nearly as precise as that. And indeed, all the books that I admire about Eliot that try and tell you about him just say, ignore the work as another way of reading the man, because translation is just not precise enough, and it will only confuse you. And I don't think that's what works of art should be anyway. I mean, you don't need to know the biography of the man in order to understand the piece, although it can sometimes help, and it might, you know, won't do any harm. Mm.
But you think he is very present in the play nevertheless, isn't he?
I think that his relationship with his wife has a lot to do with my relationship with mine in the play, yeah. But
well, he didn't actually kill her, but he did rather lock her away, didn't he? Or perhaps he did, in a roundabout way, destroy her.
I think there were friends of hers who felt that he didn't save her life when he might have done. Mm. Yeah. So in that sense, he might have caused her death. But, of course, you know, that's just a matter of opinion. It's also famously an open question as to whether Harry kills his wife in the play. I mean, I think in the end he probably doesn't, but you'll have to make up your own mind.
Well, you mentioned Eliot's accent. How do you speak when you're being upper-class people before the Second World War? Do you have to put on a special voice or not?
No, I speak in fairly refined RP, but I don't say orf. I say hotel and room, but I'm not talking like that. No, I think that's rather sort of distancing. So I talk, you know, as close to my normal RP as I can. Try not to get too many South London vowels in there. But again, that's something that I think can really get in the way of understanding. And you know, posh people don't think they're posh; they just are. It's like clever people don't think they're clever. I can't bear those performances of you know, dons who go around saying sort of clever things. Dons just do say clever things. Don't play him clever. He's just clever. Mm. Don't show me.
Yeah. In fact, upper class people tend to do estuary now, don't they? Anyway, they want to show that they're not do have a glass to be your mate.
More and more, although I think probably in 1939 it was a moot question. I mean, what's happened to the aristocracy post-war is really fascinating, because you can feel the storm clouds gathering, not just of the war, but of the dreadful... Well, I mean, dreadful if you happen to be an aristocrat. I don't think they were dreadful at all. But the post-war taxes imposed by the new Labour government that meant that at some point in the 40s, I think in the late 40s, country houses were being knocked down at the rate of three a week. And James Lees Milne, you know, cycling round them all, trying to say, is this worth saving?
I'll just say that the family reunion is the centrepiece of the T.S. Eliot Festival. The Don Juan is rather boldly and brilliantly putting on, I think. The family reunion itself runs between the 20th of November and the 10th of January next year, and tickets can be purchased by ringing 0870 060 6624.